Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a picture of the State Department sidelined by personal politics. Since President Trump took office, veteran diplomats have voiced concerns about a hollowing out of traditional U.S. diplomacy. The impeachment inquiry is now revealing just how far that has gone. William Burns is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Before that, he worked in the diplomatic corps for more than three decades. His tenure took him from ambassador of Russia to deputy secretary of state. And he says he's never been more concerned about the future of the State Department than he is today. Ambassador Burns joined me in the studio. Ambassador Burns, it's so good to see you again.
It's great to be with you, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Back in March, you came on the podcast and you told us how worried you were that the U.S. had largely abandoned traditional diplomacy. That seems to be worsening.
My concerns have certainly deepened since the spring when we last talked about this. You know, I would be the first to acknowledge that President Trump didn't invent the drift in American diplomacy. I mean, I think ever since the end of the Cold War, administrations of both parties, despite some quite significant diplomatic achievements over the years, sometimes had difficulty giving the priority to diplomacy that it required, in part because we were the singular, uncontested, dominant player on the international landscape. Today's landscape is changing. We're no longer the only big kid on the geopolitical block. So diplomacy and our ability to invest in alliances and mobilize coalitions of countries becomes even more important. And yet, at precisely the moment when diplomacy ought to matter more than ever, it's being denigrated and undermined.
The State Department seems to be taking a big hit.
I'm afraid that's true. And you can measure that either by intangible ways or intangible ones. The tangible measures of the sidelining of career public service, career diplomats, I think, is deeply troubling. Of the 28 assistant secretary level positions in the State Department, these are the senior positions around which American diplomacy organizes itself in Washington. Only one of those 28 today is held by a career diplomat confirmed by the U.S. Senate.
And the rest?
Well, and the rest are either political appointees or vacancies right now. And this is almost 3 years into administration. You also have a higher percentage today of political appointee ambassadors, 45%, than at any time in American history. And sadly, but not surprisingly, you have the depressing reality that there's been a huge drop-off in the number of young people applying to join the Foreign Service. In 2019, the lowest number of applications in more than two decades. So those are the tangible measures. The intangible measures, I think, are equally worrisome. It's the, you know, the tendency of this president to be dismissive of public service or expertise in general. When he was asked, President Trump was asked a little more than a year ago, whether he was concerned about the record number of senior vacancies in the State Department, he said, not really, because I'm the only one who matters. That, in my view, is diplomacy as an exercise in narcissism. It's not the diplomacy I learned as a young Foreign Service officer working for presidents like George H.W. Bush or secretaries of state like Jim Baker.
So here we have tension that's always gone on between the State Department and the White House. Give me an idea of why that is.
Well, I think, you know, there's been a tendency in this White House especially to cast aspersions on the so-called deep state, you know, on career bureaucrats in their argument who are fundamentally disloyal to the elected political leadership. I think that is exactly wrong. I think in the State Department, as in other parts of the executive branch, you have career public servants who are determined to do their jobs honorably. And I think what gives the lie to the criticisms of a so-called deep state is exactly what a number of my former colleagues are doing these days. They're walking up to Capitol Hill with their heads held high and they're telling the truth when they're asked by Congress. That's their obligation as public servants. And they do that however inconvenient it might be to the current administration. And they do that at considerable risk, not only to their own careers, but to themselves. And so that is what's admirable about public service. They're not deep staters. They're not skulking around trying to plot against an elected leadership. They're doing their best day in and day out. Diplomats working in hard places, doing hard work around the world as we speak today, because they're committed to the country's best interests and to carrying out the policies determined by an elected leadership as best they can.
So to whom do diplomats at the State Department take a pledge of loyalty? Is it to the President of the United States, or is it to the Constitution?
It's to the Constitution and to the country. I mean, that's the oath that all of us commit ourselves to when we join public service. That's the oath I committed myself to in 3.5 decades as a career foreign service officer, and I was proud to do it. I worked for 5 presidents, 10 secretaries of state, and administrations of both parties, and I did my level best, as my colleagues are doing today, to carry out that oath.
So in some cases, and most especially now, you do see people within the State Department working around the President and the White House, do you not?
I think actually what you see is, you know, people, especially career public servants, who are doing their best to carry out the decisions and the instructions of an elected leadership or appointed leaders like the Secretary of State. Where they have concerns about that, they try to be honest about it. That's their obligation too within the system. And I think that's largely what you've seen over the course of these last 2 or 3 years is people being honorable public servants.
And as honorable public servants, they may be going against perhaps the wishes of the White House.
Well, certainly their obligation, you know, when you're subpoenaed by the Congress or you feel a personal obligation to comply with a request to testify or do a deposition to Congress, that's what your oath is about. Even if the White House or the State Department leadership are discouraging you from doing that, your obligation based on that oath and your commitment to the country's best interests is to go up to Congress and tell the truth. That's not, I don't think, working around, you know, a White House or a political leadership. That's carrying out your obligation as a public servant.
So the fact that the President again and again has said the people in the State Department who are career employees have been working against me. I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he's saying.
And I think he's wrong. I think what career public servants in the State Department and elsewhere in the executive branch of government, whether it's civilians or military, are doing their very best to uphold that oath, their commitment to the country's best interest. And I think the Ukraine scandal is a perfect illustration of all this. Here you have evidence, not just in their depositions or their testimony, but in the summary of a presidential conversation with the president of Ukraine that was released by the White House, of a president trying to use the leverage that comes with his office and our national leverage with a foreign government in pursuit of personal political gain. And I think, you know, career public servants are being honest about that when they're asked about their concerns by the Congress.
So they would not have come forward without being subpoenaed?
There are a number of career diplomats who have come forward, or at least one or two, without formal subpoenas. One in particular, my understanding is at least Mike McKinley, who was a longtime career diplomat who left the Foreign Service and then complied with the wish of Congress to testify.
And what about career Ambassador Yovanovitch?
Mm-hmm. She's a wonderful career diplomat. We worked together in Moscow in the 1990s. I've followed and supported her career for years since then. She represents and embodies the very best of the Foreign Service. She doesn't have a political bone in her body. She's served Republicans and Democrats loyally. She's worked in some of the hardest places, not just in Ukraine, but in Central Asia and elsewhere that, you know, diplomats have to operate in, and she's done it superbly. And her integrity and professionalism got in the way of, you know, what I think was a deeply misguided scheme to use American leverage over the Ukrainian government in pursuit of personal political gain. And the price she paid for that was being deeply unfairly dismissed from her job as ambassador.
And how important do you think her testimony was?
Well, I think it was quite significant in trying to paint a picture of her concerns over the efforts that, you know, going back to the last months of her tenure that the administration, the White House, was making. It was followed by the testimony of another wonderful career public servant, Ambassador Bill Taylor, who succeeded her as our acting ambassador in Ukraine. He had earlier served for 3 years as our ambassador in Ukraine in the George W. Bush administration. And I think his testimony, at least as I understand it from reading it in the press, has been, you know, very compelling.
Do you think he was played for a patsy?
No. I mean, I think he was honest about his concerns, as his emails have, you know, revealed during this time.
But even by taking the job, which he was very reluctant to take right from the beginning.
Sure. I mean, you know, Bill Taylor has served for half a century, you know, for five decades, both, you know, after graduating from West Point in the U.S. military, fought in Vietnam, served in some really tough positions as a diplomat in the decades since then, both in the former Soviet Union and in the Middle East. So if anybody had deserved, I think, a comfortable retirement, it was Bill Taylor. He was working in an important job at the U.S. Institute for Peace. But it was because of his patriotism, his commitment, when he was asked by the Secretary of State to go back to Ukraine in this complicated period to serve as the acting ambassador after Ambassador Yovanovitch was dismissed. He did an honorable thing. He, you know, heeded that patriotic call and went back there. But he also made clear his concern that if American policy or our approach was to change to Ukraine, given the pressures that Ukraine faces from Putin's Russia, you know, that he wasn't going to stay in that position. And I think he's been quite honest and straightforward about his concerns, both in the email exchanges that have been, you know, revealed, and then in his deposition to the Congress.
I wonder how employees of the State Department are feeling right now about Secretary of State Pompeo.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly there's deep concern. It's no great secret about the direction of this president's foreign policy and what it means for career public servants. There's great concern about the dismissiveness that we were discussing before toward expertise, toward career public service. You know, foreign service officers, civil servants in the State Department don't have a monopoly on wisdom. But what they want, what we want, is for their expertise to be taken into account. Not always heeded, because political leaderships are going to, you know, have their own calculations and they have to make some tough choices. But when it's not only ignored, but derided, you know, that creates, I think, huge problems for morale. And also, I think people in the State Department, in any institution, look to their leaders to stand up for them when they're unfairly criticized or attacked. And there just has not been much evidence of that so far. And I think that's deeply dispiriting to people. What does give me, you know, a lot of faith about the future of my old profession is exactly what people like Ambassador Taylor and Ambassador Yovanovitch are doing. You know, they're embodying the best of public service by walking up to Capitol Hill and telling the truth. And that, I think, helps to demonstrate to the wider American public, which doesn't, and you can't blame them for this, you know, have any deep understanding of what diplomats do overseas or what public servants do for that matter. But this is a vivid demonstration of what honorable public servants do.
Now, a quick break. More with Ambassador William Burns when we come back. Now here's the rest of my conversation with William Burns. He's president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. I wonder how employees of the State Department, at whatever level, are feeling right now about Secretary of State Pompeo, and whether they feel they are represented by someone who really cares about their welfare.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly there's deep concern. It's no great secret about the direction of this president's foreign policy and what it means for career public servants. There's great concern about the dismissiveness that we were discussing before toward expertise, toward career public service. You know, foreign service officers, civil servants in the State Department don't have a monopoly on wisdom. But what they want, what we want, is for their expertise to be taken into account. Not always heeded, because political leaderships are going to, you know, have their own calculations and they have to make some tough choices. But when it's not only ignored, but derided, you know, that creates, I think, huge problems for morale. And also, I think people in the State Department, in any institution, look to their leaders to stand up for them when they're unfairly criticized or attacked. And there just has not been much evidence of that so far. And I think that's deeply dispiriting to people. What does give me, you know, a lot of faith about the future of my old profession is exactly what people like Ambassador Taylor and Ambassador Yovanovitch are doing. You know, they're embodying the best of public service by walking up to Capitol Hill and telling the truth. And that, I think, helps to demonstrate to the wider American public, which doesn't, and you can't blame them for this, you know, have any deep understanding of what diplomats do overseas or what public servants do for that matter. But this is a vivid demonstration of what honorable public servants do.
On the other hand, as President Trump has made clear to his supporters, is that he believes there has been this so-called deep state at work. And there are many who believe that.
Which is deeply unfortunate right now, because I think career public servants deserve the respect of American citizens because they're doing very hard jobs right now, not just those in Washington, but those overseas serving in American embassies in some very tough and oftentimes very risky places today. And I think in a perverse way, I mean, given President Trump's disdain for public service, you know, he's called public servants human scum, I think the performance of these career public servants is not only giving the lie to a lot of his deeply offensive criticism, but it's also helping Americans more broadly, who don't pay attention every day to what diplomats do, to understand the honor and the decency and the integrity that their diplomats, their public servants are demonstrating.
In a recent piece in Foreign Affairs, you wrote that what's happening now in the State Department is comparable to what happened during the McCarthy era. Mm-hmm. Take us back to that era.
Sure.
What happened then and what's happening now?
Sure. And I didn't write those words lightly.
I
wrote them out of deep concern about what's unfolding now. In the McCarthy era, you know, in the early 1950s, Senator Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin launched a savage attack on what he alleged was disloyalty in the State Department, alleging that individual career officers were either communist sympathizers or suspect in some ways. And over the course of several years, he managed to push for a whole series of so-called loyalty investigations. 81 career personnel in the State Department were forced out. One example is a gentleman named John Patton Davies, who was a China specialist spoke fluent Mandarin, had served in China for a number of years. His sin, if you want to call it that, was to accurately predict that the Chinese communists were likely to win the Civil War in the late 1940s. He was subjected to 9 separate loyalty investigations, and eventually the then Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, fired him. I think, as I mentioned that article, that was a profound act of political cowardice. Eventually, you know, McCarthy was beaten back. There was a famous exchange where a lawyer named Joseph Welch, who represented the U.S. Army in the so-called Army-McCarthy hearings in 1954, uttered his famous question, which was to Senator McCarthy, have you no decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency? That was a rhetorical question then, because it was pretty obvious what the answer was. And I'm afraid it's a rhetorical question today as we look at what, you know, the president and others in this administration are trying to do. And what's at stake is truly the hollowing out of American diplomacy and an important institution, the Department of State. And it's important for people to recognize that and understand it and to reverse it over time.
How many career diplomats were let go as a result of the McCarthy hearings?
Well, there were 81 State Department personnel who were forced out over a course of several years in the early 1950s. You know, and in this administration, you had a number of very senior officers who were essentially forced out, who left because they didn't have any career options at the very beginning of this administration. There are others at the middle level who have left since then. And that's what, you know, begins to create a hollowing out of an institution.
What was the long-term impact after the McCarthy era? And what do you perceive the long-term impact could be now?
Well, one of the practical consequences of McCarthyism for the State Department, because a number of the so-called China hands, China specialists like John Patton Davies were forced out, was to blind American policy on China for a generation. And we paid a price for that over time. And what I worry about now, not only with the sidelining of career expertise and the departures of some extremely capable Foreign Service officers, is that young people are going to be discouraged from joining the Foreign Service, which I think is a wonderful profession. I, you know, was incredibly lucky over 3.5 decades. And I hope very much that young people in your listening audience will see the opportunity that public service provides, especially diplomatic service as well. But it's deeply discouraging to see such a big drop off, you know, in the number of people applying for the Foreign Service after so many years in which that number had risen.
Can that drop off be directly paired with Trump coming into office?
Yeah, I think you just have to look at the numbers. For 2 decades until this administration, almost every year the number of applications had risen through administrations of both parties. In the last 2 or 3 years, it's dropped precipitously.
Going back to the McCarthy era, Roy Cohn was Joe McCarthy's right-hand man, as it were. And apparently, President Trump seems to want a Roy Cohn by his side. What were the characteristics of Roy Cohn that President Trump now finds so desirable and wishes he had him beside him?
Well, President Trump, in one of, you know, history's sad ironies, did have his Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn himself was, you know, one of his principal mentors and advisors, you know, early in his career in New York in real estate. Roy Cohn embodied in many ways the worst of the way in which people have gone after career public servants. His scorched earth tactics, mean-spiritedness, dismissiveness and disdain for career public service was all vividly illustrated in the McCarthy era in the early 1950s. And there's more than a passing resemblance you know, between the playbook that President Trump has employed in his attacks on public service and, you know, what the playbook that Roy Kahn wrote for Joe McCarthy more than six decades ago.
How long did it take after that statement of have you no decency? Mm-hmm. How long did it take for members of Congress to stand up finally against Joe McCarthy?
Well, there were some early profiles, legitimate profiles in Courage. Senator Margaret Chait Smith from Maine in 1950, so at the very beginning of McCarthy's onslaught, stood up quite courageously, especially as a Republican, and spoke out against this as well. So there were some courageous voices, you know, amongst Republicans at the time, responding to a fellow Republican senator. But then after the Army McCarthy hearings, you know, it really began to pick up momentum as well. But it took several years, and those early profiles in Courage, like Margaret Chait Smith, were pretty rare at that time. And so you can only hope that, you know, in today's Congress, people will recall that courageous example.
And thus far, we've not seen anything like that emerge.
Now, there's been very little evidence of it. You know, you have an impeachment inquiry that's underway right now. But what you don't have is, you know, a lot of people who are standing up in defense of public servants, even as that inquiry proceeds.
Do you think the Republicans have room and right to complain about the process as it is now going on, that is being conducted behind closed doors? They protested mm-hmm. in great numbers the other day by storming that closed-door hearing. What's your feeling about that?
My feeling is, as a citizen, I'm not an expert in impeachment inquiries or processes. You know, my background is as a diplomat. But what I would say is that, you know, it seems to me that any process, if it's going to capture the attention and the respect of the American people, does need to be as transparent as possible. My understanding is that the deposition process that's ongoing is, you know, a part of the normal process that's laid out in the Constitution, that both Democrats and Republicans have an opportunity to question witnesses or those who are giving depositions. And so in that sense, I think, you know, the criticism that it's somehow unbalanced seems to me to be without foundation. From everything I read, I assume that there's going to be a public phase of this as well, with public testimony. And I have no doubt, just looking at some of my former colleagues, that they're going to be just as honest and straightforward and compelling in public testimony as it appears they've been in their depositions
as
well.
So you believe that the same people, for example, Ambassador Yovanovitch, would testify publicly as she has privately?
Yeah, my assumption is that what you'll see is a kind of public phase of what we've seen privately. And if Ambassador Yovanovitch, for example, is asked to testify in public, I'm absolutely certain that she's going to be just as honest and straightforward as she has been in her deposition.
Ambassador Burns, what do you see as the long-term consequences of what has happened in Ukraine?
I think the big beneficiary of recent events in Ukraine, of this scandal, is Vladimir Putin. You know, Vladimir Putin, because of his professional training in the KGB, is quite adept at creating compromising material on all sorts of political opponents. I don't think he could have manufactured in his wildest imagination a more disruptive document than the summary of the telephone conversation between President Trump and President Zelensky. So for Putin, what's unfolding in Ukraine now is a twofer. He's sowing further dysfunction in Ukraine, which makes it easier for him to manipulate Ukraine and continue to take advantage of Ukraine. And he's sowing further dysfunction in the United States indirectly. And so in a sense, if you look back to Putin's effort to interfere in our elections in 2016, he succeeded beyond his wildest imagination in that he has fed even greater dysfunction and difficulty and polarization in our political system as well.
So, Mr. Putin comes out the big winner here.
In many respects, I think that's true. And, you know, Putin has always said publicly in recent years that, you know, it's not his fault, I'm paraphrasing, but it's not his fault if he plays a weak hand strongly. And it's not his fault that the United States tends to play a strong hand weakly. And in what we've seen, you know, in the unfolding Ukraine scandal, Putin has taken advantage, and he'll continue to if we give him opportunities.
And turning now for just a moment to what's happened in Syria, how do you see that affecting the world in its unbalance? Certainly at this point, Russia can claim that it has Syria's best interests in mind, but
I'm deeply skeptical of that, that Russia has Syria's best interests at heart. I mean, you know, Russia has supported to the hilt the regime of Bashar al-Assad that has in effect, in order to preserve itself in power, destroyed its country and its society at huge cost to in Syrian life and in displaced Syrians as well. But Putin is an adept counterpuncher, and so he's taken advantage of the opportunity that we have helped to provide in northern Syria in recent weeks. And he's used that to, you know, further strengthen Russia's influence and its diplomatic role in the Middle East. I mean, I think in many respects, the president's decision to begin to pull out, at least from northern Syria, U.S. forces was a betrayal. It was a betrayal of a partner. It was a betrayal of the Kurds, you know, who had bled for us in the fight against ISIS. It was a betrayal of process in the sense that, you know, he was acting impulsively and in a way that didn't reflect any consultation with his most senior advisors in the U.S. government, let alone with allied and partner governments. But most of all, I think it was a betrayal of common sense. I mean, if we're honest with ourselves, it was always going to be hard to sustain an American military presence, a pretty modest military presence in northern and eastern Syria indefinitely. It only gave us modest leverage over the future of that part of Syria. But I've always thought there was a smart way and a dumb way to manage that leverage and use it to contribute to at least a semblance of some kind of order in northern Syria. We chose the dumb way. You know, in one telephone conversation, the president impulsively said that we would withdraw our forces. He, in effect, gave away our leverage, stood aside. The Turks invaded and came across the border. Then we launched into a hasty negotiation, which essentially resulted in President Erdogan of Turkey getting everything he wanted. The big beneficiaries were Putin and President Erdogan, who just met a couple of days ago in Russia, and that's the place where the future of northern Syria was being decided. The Assad regime is a beneficiary. The Iranians are a beneficiary. And I fear, ultimately, it's ISIS that's going to be a beneficiary because it's going to use the chaos, the grievance, the insecurity that's resulting now in northern Syria to try to revive itself, because that's the atmosphere in which it thrives. So it just seems to me that not only are the Kurds big losers in all this, they've essentially been thrown under the bus, but our interests, you know, are also significantly damaged.
Finally, Ambassador Burns, how do you see the United States being viewed by countries around the world as a result of these decisions by the White House?
Well, I think the problem reflected in these decisions we were just discussing in Syria and Turkey, but also in a whole sequence of decisions made over the last two or three years, abandoning agreements like the Paris Climate Treaty, like the Iran Nuclear Agreement, it creates a sense of deep uncertainty, which causes our allies to start to lose faith and to hedge because they're not sure about our reliability. It causes our adversaries and our rivals, whether it's Putin's Russia, Xi Jinping's China, the Iranians, to take advantage. And you see clear evidence of that. And it causes the institutions that we work so hard to help shape over 70 years to begin to wobble at exactly the moment, you know, when they need to be adapted to reflect the landscape of 2019, not, you know, the late 1940s or 1989 or any of another of transformative moments on the international landscape. Instead, You know, we've embarked upon a very unpredictable, erratic, and essentially unilateralist approach, which, as I said, causes allies to lose faith, adversaries to take advantage, and institutions to wobble.
And Pastor Burns, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Diane.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Our engineer this week is Natalie Uriv-Lipker. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.